director of Peninsula Peace and Justice, Paul George, returning again. Sorry about not getting you on more often. We need to, Paul, because there's so much to talk about. But as we both entered the room, I looked at you and said, okay, if we're bringing Julian Assange up on treason charges and we're going to execute Bradley Manning, the young man accused of leaking this stuff, then don't we have to go out and arrest Karl Rove and Dick Cheney for Valerie Plame?
Well, I think we should do, you know, go the Tea Party route and just shoot them.
But we don't advocate killing anybody on this show.
No, absolutely not.
As a matter of fact, I have to read.
It's over-the-top sarcasm. But seriously, right. Bird, you know, think about this. We have had leading politicians in this country just say that they should assassinate Julian Assange.
Right.
Well, if that's the case, then Scooter Libby should be in the crosshairs, because what he revealed, the identity of Valerie Plame, who was
an active,
in-the-field, right. undercover agent doing very important work for this country,
right.
Counter-proliferation activity, counter-nuclear proliferation activity.
And like Fox News would say, how many people died as a result? And we don't know. The CIA would never tell us.
We don't know.
But we know some probably did, right?
We can guess that they did because, you know, Valerie Plame was deep undercover,
mm-hmm.
had a lot of contacts in other countries, including nuclear scientists in Iraq who were willing to talk to the United States before the invasion. They were all compromised. She tried to get them out. She couldn't get them out. And before the invasion happened, those people's lives were at risk. And who knows what happened? You know, she worked all over the world in counterproliferation, had contacts, had informants. And once her cover was blown, those people were at risk.
Now, and the mainstream media in this country pretty much wrote her off like, well, we've been told her work wasn't that important. That's what the side said. Remember that? You know, Fox News and not all of them, but a lot of them said that, well, her work wasn't that important. It really didn't matter that much. Bob Novak, the now deceased journalist who was in the middle of the whole scandal.
Right. Well, I'm not sure we should use the word journalist with Robert Novak.
Thank you.
But beyond that, yeah, you know, he was complicit in this.
Oh, he admitted it.
Well, he wrote it in his column.
Right. They leaked it to him, and then he's the one that put it out.
And it's pretty clear that, you know, it was Scooter Libby who was convicted of a related crime. He wasn't convicted under the revealing espionage.
Right, right. Now, since Novak put it out, wasn't he in the same position that Julian Assange is in right now? Julian Assange has got the information, so he put it out. Okay.
Right.
He didn't steal the information. It was given to him and he put it out, right?
Right.
Now, isn't that what Robert Novak did with Valerie Plame? He got the information and then he put it out. He outed her in his article.
Yeah, it's
so wasn't
it's,
that treason?
It's a pretty
slippery slope.
Yeah, it's a pretty equal position, and you know, there are laws on the books about revealing the names of operatives. They tried to prosecute Philip Agee for that, and that's why he left the country and went to Cuba.
Well, one of the harshest laws was written during the first Bush administration, Papa Bush, George H.W.,
uh-huh.
Herbert Walker Bush, and because he had been from the CIA,
right,
he pushed that real hard that if anybody messes with, you know, outing CIA agents. And then years later, his son got to be president, and during his administration, they out a CIA agent?
Right.
Is that not treason?
It should be.
I sure should. And then they bring a low-level Dick Cheney's assistant up on charges, but he never even went to jail? And now they're saying Julian Assange and WikiLeaks should be what? This is crazy.
Yeah.
It's all upside down.
It is crazy. And, you know, there's a lot about this WikiLeaks and the way that, you know, the official Washington is reacting to it.
And the rest of the world, too. Because we're starting to get word from the rest of the world that they're a little disappointed in the way America's been acting behind the scenes. They pretty much knew it all along.
Well, they have known it, but now, you know, it's
out
in front of everybody, and they kind of have to react. You know, over the weekend, I was thinking, I don't know if this is related, but it's a fun story anyway. Back when I was in college in Washington, D.C., I went to see a Frank Zappa concert one evening, and it was Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And to start the show, Zappa came out on stage by himself, And it was just a straight back plain chair that had been set there in the middle of the stage. And he just walked out, sat down in the chair, and sat. And, you know, the first 30 seconds for a minute, the audience was kind of laughing and looking at him. And then they started getting impatient and doing one of those clapping things, you know, like they do it at ballparks, you know, drive the guy in. And then it started to get a little ugly and people started booing and hissing and getting angry at Zappa, you know. And after about 5 minutes, just sitting there quietly, you know, staring at the audience and getting these angry reactions, he finally gets up and walks up to the microphone and says, "It's easy to bring out the beast in you, isn't it?" And this is a bunch of hippies. Well, the beast is out in Washington, you know. Yeah. We're really seeing how some of these people think. You know, when you have leading politicians calling for the assassination of somebody for something like this, this is really ugly. This is what the media should be concentrating on, you know, not where is Julian and, you know, what laws should he be prosecuted under, but where do these U.S. politicians get off calling for the assassination of somebody? Whatever happened to due process? You know, that's supposed to be meat and potatoes in this country. And then, you know, trying to find ways to prosecute them. You have Joe Lieberman, chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, calling up Amazon.com and not too subtly threatening them and getting Amazon to throw WikiLeaks off their servers. PayPal threw them off this weekend. I imagine there were some phone calls that led PayPal to do that.
How much longer do you think he's going to last? I bet people are taking bets on it. They're going after him with everything they got. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they are. You know, going back to the release of the Afghanistan and Iraq documents, though, and he's reiterated this time around, Julian Assange says he has a silver bullet.
He calls it insurance. Isn't it a file called insurance?
Yep. It's a file called insurance.
I'm dying to see that.
Yeah. It's you got to wonder what it is. And maybe he's let them know what it is.
They probably do know what it is. They probably know. They know what was in the file that whoever leaked it, you know, they do know. Who knows? I don't know if they know or not. Paul George is our guest for the hour. Peninsula Peace and Justice. This is the guy on the cutting edge of, in this area of, social justice in all different, every week you got something else going on. It's Cuba. It's Afghanistan. You're bringing speakers in. And the TV show is tomorrow night, right?
TV show is tomorrow night. It's Dr. Ali Ferdowsi, who's the head of the political science department at Notre Dame Denamer University, just up the peninsula in Belmont.
What are you guys going to be talking about?
We're going to be talking about Iran. And,
just got yellow cake yesterday and admitted to it.
Yeah. Well, they're a sovereign country. It's their minerals. And under international law, it's perfectly legal for them to process their own uranium to power nuclear power plants.
Yeah, one would think, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's what they say they're going to do.
So, you know, we're going to be talking about Iran. Ali Ferdowsi is a native of Iran, spent some time in jail under the Shah back then. Last time he was on the program was last year, just after the elections and all the street protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Ferdowsi had been there for a lot of the protests, know a lot of the people who were picked up from the streets and thrown in prison. He said that this current regime is even worse than the Shah was. And, you know, he was in jail under the Shah as a pro-democracy activist. Mm-hmm. So he knows what he's talking about. And the interesting thing is he always has really good insights, because he continues to go back to Iran every summer. When school is out, he goes there to do political research. He's pretty well known in the country, not liked by the regime because, he's on the left side of the spectrum, opposes the regime, is pro-democracy, pro-human rights.
They don't mess with him, though, when he goes there, huh?
No, they don't seem to, because he is fairly well known, but, you know, it's a dangerous thing for him to do.
Totally.
So anyway, he's always up to date, and so that's tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the Community Media Center, and we welcome people to come on down to the studio. It's 900 San Antonio Road in Palo Alto. It's right down near near 101. It's down that far end of San Antonio Road.
Yeah, people are the live TV audience.
That's right.
And, it's cable access, but it can be seen on the internet and on cable TV.
Yeah,
too,
it can
right?
be seen on Channel 27 in the Mid-Peninsula area and online at the Media Center's website, which is Mid-Pen Media, M-I-D-P-E-N media.org. And just look for their streaming webpage and pick Channel 27. Should be a really good conversation. He's a fun guy, too. He's got a great sense of humor, even though he's paid his price for his pro-democracy work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's tomorrow. And as long as we're on the Peace and Justice Center's calendar, a week from tomorrow is a screening of a just-completed film called Reclaiming Their Voice. And this is a film by local award-winning filmmaker Dorothy Fadiman, who and the film is about the voting rights struggle of Native Americans in New Mexico. And I've seen a rough cut of it several months ago. It's now just finished. And so we'll be presenting that film.
She'll be our guest on this show next Monday.
Next Monday, yeah.
Because she's been on the show before. And, we're very excited about that movie. She went in depth. She went down there to be a witness.
Yeah.
And then when she got back from there, about how they were stealing the vote from Native Americans, when she got back, it marked her. And as a documentary filmmaker, she decided, I have to tell this story. And it's a story about how the Native Americans in the Southwest are getting ripped off, just like people of color all over the United States, the ones in Florida. It's not just people of color either, because after the last election in 08, we came to find out that a lot of votes were still stolen. Even though Barack Obama won,
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of votes still stolen, weren't there?
Yeah, well, this is Dorothy's second film focusing on voting irregularities, whether it's denying people their rights or flat-out stealing elections and that sort of thing. Her previous one was called Stealing America, Vote by Vote.
Right.
Really powerful documentary.
She had been in Florida for 2000. Wasn't it? Or 2004.
She that film was all over the place. She was in Florida. She was in Ohio. A lot in Ohio. Pennsylvania, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Really good film. She's won an Emmy Award. She's been nominated for an Academy Award for her film. So she's a local treasure and a valuable person to have around and to listen to. So
a week from tomorrow night.
Week from tomorrow night, and part of why we picked this program, I was looking around for a program. Actually, December 15th, very few people know this, and we don't get the day off or anything, but December 15th is Bill of Rights Day. That's
really?
The anniversary of when the Bill of Rights, the first 14 amendments, or first 12 amendments to the Constitution were brought into force after having been approved by a majority of the states back in the early days of our republic, 1789, I believe it was. And so I was looking around for a program to mark that, remind ourselves we got a lot of work still ahead of us to restore our constitutional protections that were left in such fragile shape by 8 years of the Bush administration. And
how much of the Bill of Rights is still applicable today, or how much is gone?
We have these days kind of what I think of as the Reader's Digest version of the of the Constitution with all the unnecessary rights and privileges, kind of written out.
Freedom of speech was taken away during the protests for the Iraq War, and even some of the political protests when the kids would show up at the national conventions of the Republican and Democratic parties. Yeah. Cops would beat them up. They wouldn't let them talk. Freedom of assembly.
They will say that freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, both of which are
part of the Bill of Rights.
In the First Amendment, the very first one. Both of those are in there. The right of the people peaceably to assemble, to ask for redress of grievances of the government, and freedom of speech, have been severely curtailed. They exist in name still, but
You can't assemble.
When you go to, you know, protest, say a political party convention, they give you a free speech zone, you know, that is fenced off far away from the convention center,
right,
far away from anybody who should be hearing it, can hear it.
Is that legal?
Yeah, the courts have found that it's legal as long as, you know, it's not. They've upheld restrictions on.
So you don't have the right to go right up to the front door and go, hey, man, we don't agree with what you're doing.
Right. Yeah, the Supreme Court has put time and place restrictions on freedom of speech, things
that's
like
not
that.
But that's not what the Founding Fathers meant when they wrote the Bill of Rights, right?
No, I don't think. You know, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but,
yeah, but I mean, it's right
I think they had a rather broader vision of what freedom of speech and freedom of assembly meant. You know, there was just a recent case, a recent action by the Obama administration that I wrote about on my blog recently because it kind of ticked me off. At the checkpoints, the security checkpoints at airports,
yeah,
people coming into the United States. Now, the courts have ruled that for security reasons, the Fourth Amendment, the protections against unreasonable search and seizure,
mm-hmm,
can be stretched a bit because of security concerns, and especially after 9/11. But what they had been doing, and courts had upheld this, was without any suspicion of wrongdoing, the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, was allowed to seize people's laptops, search their laptops, copy all the everything on the laptop, share all that information with all other government agencies, all without suspicion of wrongdoing, all without any kind of warrant, search warrant, court review, anything like that.
You're saying that's legal?
That is legal.
That's not legal.
And to me, it seems like a pretty unreasonable search and seizure.
Totally.
Well, the Obama administration had been being pressed by civil liberties advocates to address this,
uh-huh,
and they did.
Okay.
And what they said was, well, if the laptop is going to be held for more than 5 days, it has to be approved by a supervisor.
Oh, my God. That's all they said?
That's all they said.
So they're backing it up. They're down with it.
Well, they're basically backing it up. It's the main thing of seizing the computer and all the contents. This is not like searching someone's luggage.
Right.
Okay. Now,
it's like going through your underwear.
We have security concerns and things like that.
Right.
And, you know, so we give up some of this. You allow them to look through your luggage so that the plane that you're on isn't going to blow up.
Right.
But a laptop computer is not luggage. You know, your financial records are on there.
Right.
You know, all your correspondence is on there. And it's not the same as you know, going through your change of clothes.
If they have your login, couldn't they log in and put stuff in there to frame you?
Well, yeah, you know.
I mean, what kind of
sense
does that
make? That's the least of my worries. My concern is that they can take all the information off your computer, and it goes out into these government computer systems.
Uh-huh.
And next thing you know, Bird's laptop stuff is the next thing up on WikiLeaks. And,
right.
And
that's insane.
We don't want to read that.
No, you sure don't. Not about me. Paul George is the guest, Peninsula Peace and Justice, and we're talking about some current events here that they won't talk about on the mainstream media. And if they do, they just whitewash it. Or they have some excuse for it. The mainstream media really does bend that way too, doesn't it? I mean, you know, they go right along with it. They don't question. You don't see them standing up and going, wait a minute, is that legal to read somebody, you know, scan somebody's laptop? That shouldn't be right.
You know, and I didn't read about that anywhere in the mainstream media. It was,
of course.
It was from Glenn Greenwald at Salon, and he is a constitutional scholar. And
yeah.
He was a little agitated over this. So anyway, that's the point of next week's screening. It kind of fits in with our Bill of Rights, and I thought it was a good idea to have a program and remind people that we do have a Bill of Rights that are supposed to protect us against unreasonable search and seizure, supposed to protect our freedom of speech and freedom of assembly.
You know, maybe if we all read the Bill of Rights ourselves, you know, I got to admit, I've never sat down and read it. And it wasn't required reading when I was in school. I know it was a couple generations before me. they used to make the kids read the Constitution, and some kids even carried it around in their back pocket. But if we all just read the Bill of Rights, maybe we would be shocked by how much we don't have. Maybe that should be what one of the things to wake up the people. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a good idea. You know, an interesting thing when you talk about it, you didn't get it in school and stuff.
Yeah.
I did. It was either junior high or maybe freshman year or something in civics class.
Yeah.
We had a whole, you know, study section a week or two on the Bill of Rights and what was in there, and we had to read it and learn about it. But the teacher also came up with a really interesting class project that was kind of an eye-opener to all of us. And what we did was we take the Bill of Rights and kind of rewrote it in everyday language, that people should have the right to do this. And took it around door to door as kind of a petition to see if people would sign it. And most people wouldn't sign it. They thought it was too radical.
Really?
It was very interesting. It was quite an eye-opener for a young person that, you know, this is our Constitution. But a lot of people didn't want to go along with it.
So you think people have been conditioned over the years to just feel like they really shouldn't even have the right to have rights?
Simplistically, yes. That's I think we do get conditioned to allow our rights to be eroded, and especially in a period like this post 9/11 period.
Well, they beat us over the head with that for 10 years now.
But, you know, as Ben Franklin once wrote, those who would give up simple liberties for those who would give up liberties for simple security deserve neither.
Right. And the people will always get the government they deserve.
So, you know, when we talk about, you know, our soldiers over in Afghanistan and Iraq fighting for our freedoms. I mean, these are the freedoms that we're talking about.
Yeah. And it's so funny, too, because a lot of the returning soldiers are starting to speak up now, and they're trying to get their rights from the VA, but they're also noticing that, hey, wait a minute. You know, you guys told us that we went over there and we're fighting for freedom, but we don't have it back here.
Right.
In fact, the last time the Iraq Vets Against the War tried to protest, didn't they get stomped by police horses?
They've been met
brutally.
Brutally. You know, and this has a long history. It's interestingly enough, you know, talking about this attitude that, you know, we're over there fighting for our freedoms, but we come home and can't find them here and not given to them here.
Yeah.
Back in the very earliest days of the Vietnam protest, in fact, some of the first people to protest the Vietnam War back in the early 60s were straight out of the civil rights movement. And they were young black men who were exposed to the draft. And they said, why should we go fight your war when our rights here at home are being denied? And they were the very first draft resistors back in the 60s. I'm talking like 63, 64, long before the actual Vietnam protests really, really took off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of history, that's why one movement leads to another. You can't break the movement for human rights and democracy and freedom down into constituent parts. It's all a vast struggle. And
they've managed to do that, though, in the sense that a lot of liberals don't know what to do about immigration. They feel like they can't speak to it. They feel like they'd be a lot of liberals will not say, well, wait a minute, maybe those people should be able to just be here. A lot of liberals will bend and say, well, now, wait a minute. OK, they are illegal and we need to do something. But, you know, it's almost like they got us chopped up in little compartments where you got the immigration people over here. So we'll mess with them because people are being hauled away to secret prisons down in the southern United States now. And mm-hmm. a lot of us don't, you know, we're aware of it, but it's not on our front screen. You know, we're not. And a lot of liberals aren't on that fight addressing it. We're talking about the war and stuff. Now you got the kids that they're taking away all the education from. They're these different fronts, right?
Yeah.
But they've got them separated into these compartments to where we're not. If we were all able to come together and fight for each other's cause together, right? that would be the move. That would be a movement that couldn't be stopped.
Well, one would hope so, yeah. But
how do you get everybody together?
Well, that's I don't know. If I had that answer, I wouldn't be sitting here.
Paul George is the guest for the hour. Peninsula Peace and Justice, always a pleasure to have you come by, and we converse for an hour. Gosh knows there's enough to talk about. How about what we found out from WikiLeaks about the United States military being in a lot more countries than we thought and fighting in a lot more countries than we thought?
Well, the information has been out there. I mean, American soldiers have been killed in Pakistan, and they're not supposed to be there.
They're not supposed to be there.
And in Yemen and in Somalia.
Yeah,
and,
that's Africa.
And we're firing off Predator drone missiles in those same countries. Yemen even covering up for us and saying that it's their missiles.
You know, it's so easy for us to say drone strike, and we've heard it so many times, we just say drone strike. And I don't think the average American even can even imagine what that means when you say a drone strike. But we got a perfect example of it. I had kind of an epiphany. The San Bruno gas fire that wiped out 47 houses. It mm-hmm. was that gas line that exploded, and the fire was so hot, it was underneath one house. The line was so big, the fire was so hot, it actually burned the 47 houses around it. The firefighters couldn't even get near it until they were able to turn off the gas. I kind of liken that 47, that's a scar in the middle of a neighborhood. 47 houses are gone. They're going to rebuild them if they can. That's kind of like a drone strike. You know?
Yeah, it's probably a little more powerful than that. But, you know, just to consider the fact that we have the technology where these things can go and hover and watch people in the dark and then fire off a missile. They're being controlled out of a base in Nevada, I think it is.
Yeah, Creech Air Force Base.
And, you know, you've got basically video game jockeys thousands of miles away blowing up people halfway around the earth.
That they've never seen, met, and they don't have anything against.
Right. It's, you know, it's scary stuff.
It's insane,
and
is what it is.
It's much more widespread than is talked about very much in the mainstream media.
It's been a very well-kept secret, and they got it down to a word now. They just go, oh, drone strike, or suspected terrorists were... and they could never say it was for sure.
Yeah, this is the one that gets me, is, you know, a suspected U.S. strike. Well, who else is firing off drone missiles around the world?
That is so true. It's insane what's going on. And I'm glad we have these airwaves open enough to talk about this stuff, because I think once the public wakes up to this, if they can, and if they do, you know, the Tea Party people have a real point. They do. They're angry. They got ripped off. We all got ripped off, you know. They're kind of misguided in some of their ways, just by a little bit, you know. There's some racist undertones there that shouldn't be there. But the Tea Party people have an energy that we all kind of wish we had, you know, that kind of vitriol, like, hey, you guys ripped us off, mm-hmm. and you need to get out of here. We're going to fire you, and we're going to replace you with somebody. They did it. It's going to get a little crazy up on Capitol Hill in the next 2 years.
Oh, it's going to be very it's been crazy.
It'll be a lot of gridlock. There'll be a lot of vetoes on bills. And,
well,
there's
already been a lot of gridlock. You know, speaking of the elections, though, and you know, throwing people out and stuff, I just read some interesting statistics about this that, you know, the Republicans up on Capitol Hill are now saying, you know, the deficit.
Right.
That's what we've got to talk about. We've got to reduce the deficit.
Yeah.
While they want to go out and renew tax breaks for the wealthiest 2% of the people in the country and add $600 billion to the deficit.
Extend the Bush tax breaks
every year.
How much is that going to cost us?
I think
just extending the Bush tax breaks, which is for all the millionaires?
It's something like $4 trillion over 10 years or something like that.
That's insane.
Just for those top 2%.
It's going to cost us for another $4 trillion, and we're $14 trillion in debt right now, right?
But here's my point. Is that not long before the elections, a lot of highly respected and usually accurate national opinion polls you know, talked to voters to see what their main concerns were.
Uh-huh.
And number one, far and away the top, with over 50% support, was jobs. We need jobs. Pretty basic, and that's what you would expect.
Yeah.
Reducing the deficit was fourth or fifth in line, and it was in single digits, like 4 or 5%. But during the campaign, the Republicans kept saying, oh, it's the deficit, it's the deficit. So that when election time came around and they did exit polls, the deficit had moved up quite substantially in what people were voting on. And it tells me that the Republicans definitely moved people away from the real concern, which was jobs and still is,
yeah,
to a completely false issue, the deficit.
Isn't that what they say when the tail wags the dog?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it,
I guess. It's kind of like the tail wagging the dog, right? Who are they to be changing the subject and telling us? And these polls are, like you said, fairly accurate.
Yeah, they, you know, you can, I wouldn't suggest anybody run policy based on polls, but yeah. It does seem like they've got a pretty good handle. They know how to kind of put their finger on the pulse of the electorate to find out what the concerns are. And when you ask people, you know, these questions in polls, people usually get it right. And it's actually a pretty progressive kind of attitude.
Yeah.
You know, these recent elections, jobs was number one. In previous elections, something about the spiraling cost of health care was always way up there. People
sure.
wanted health care reform. But then you get these demagogues out there, you know, with their death panels and stuff, and real health care reform gets completely undermined. You know, what Obama managed to get passed in terms of health care reform in this atmosphere, I'm amazed that he got anything passed. But
right.
the important stuff got completely undermined, like the public option. But as we've talked about on this program, I do think it was an important step forward because at least we got it addressed. Now we're going to be fighting the fight of not seeing it rolled back to you know, where we were in 2008, which was just a disaster. This country cannot afford to see healthcare costs continuing to increase the way they have been for many years.
There is a bill in the California legislature that's been there for quite a few years. Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed it twice, and it's written by Mark Leno here in San Francisco for single payer for California. And a lot of the pundits are saying it might come down to a states' rights issue where each state has to decide what kind of health care they want for their people. I've talked to a few representatives myself locally, and they were all down with voting for it. It's now we have to see if Jerry Brown has the political spine to help it get through. The bill's been written, and they voted on it.
It actually goes back before Leno. It was first introduced by Sheila Kuhl.
Okay.
I think she's from Fremont or Hayward, and she fought that through for years, and it was actually her bill when it first passed, she was term limited out, and Mark Leno, as you say, from San Francisco, has picked it up.
Torch.
Yeah.
Yeah, single payer for California, that would be the thing, wouldn't it?
You know, that's probably the way we need to go.
Yeah. Make it a states' rights issue.
Show you how long this has been an issue. I worked for the California Single Payer Ballot Initiative back in 1996. We had it on the ballot.
Wow.
To institute a single payer system for California. The thought then was, okay, we'll do it. This was in the wake of Bill Clinton getting shot down and blowing the whole health care reform. Back in, you know, he came into office in, what, 92?
Right.
You know,
his re-election was in 96.
And so
he gave away welfare, as we know it.
Yeah. So, you know, this has been a long struggle. The real answers are out there. And I'm convinced that it's a single-payer kind of system.
Sure.
And the thought back in 96 was, well, we'll set it up here in California, and it can be an example for the rest of the country and spread like wildfire when they see it happen.
Yeah.
Well, the insurance companies were thinking the same thing, right. only that that was a dangerous thing to do. So, you know, we managed to raise, on the pro single payer side, $5 million for the ballot proposition.
Which is one day of the insurance company's lobby, right?
Well, almost. They poured in from around the country $50 million to defeat that. And it was another one of these situations where they convinced people to vote against their own best interests. And it just happens time and time again. Here we are, you know, 14 years later, still fighting these same fights.
It's like Ben Franklin said, the people get the government they deserve. If they did vote against their own self-interest, it's their fault. Talking to Paul George from Peninsula Peace and Justice, and speaking of all this, what do you think the Tea Party people are going to do when they run smack dab into the Washington establishment, okay? They've come up for... They went up to Capitol Hill to get orientated. Now, in January, they're going to get, inaugurated into office there. And these Tea Party people who are pretty radical, and they want to, like, no more spending, and let's curb all this. Let's straighten out the government. We're going to shrink government back down again, which they never happens, right?
Uh-huh.
The Washington establishment is going to swallow them and tell them how it really works up there. They're not going to get their way. They're kind of fighting for some of the stuff we want. They don't want to see taxes go crazy. Are the Tea Party people going to be in favor of extending the Bush tax cuts for millionaires? They're not all millionaires. Are they in on that?
Well, they all seem to be so far, yeah.
Isn't that funny?
But
how could they be?
You know, we don't have the Tea Party class installed yet, and of course the Congress is going to take some kind of action on these Bush tax cuts before they adjourn, before this Congress ends, because they have to. The tax cuts expire December 31st.
It looks like the deal's been made.
It does look like the deal has been made.
Yeah, we get unemployment insurance extended if they get the Bush tax cuts extended for at least another year, right?
For 2 years seems
seems
to be the number that they're settling on, which tells you, these aren't temporary tax cuts. They were supposed to be temporary when Bush passed them. That was part of what supposedly got them passed. I mean,
wasn't the original income tax made back in 1913 or somewhere to pay for World War One when it was instituted? Wasn't that supposed to be temporary? And they just kept extending it to the point where now we just take it for granted that the government has the right to take money out of our paycheck?
Yeah, that's pretty much the case, that it was supposed to be temporary. You know, what happened, it's kind of interesting, a little odd twist of history, but it's how these things happen. It was prohibitionists who wanted to ban the sale of alcohol in this country, who saw an opportunity. The problem was for the prohibitionists was that they knew that the government was mostly funded by alcohol tax, and the income tax was seen as a way of replacing that, and they could finally get rid of alcohol sales in this country, because then they could get there was replacement revenue now.
But wasn't there, didn't people get upset about that the first time they started stealing money out of your paycheck to fund the government?
I don't know what the reaction was.
There must have been something. Somebody standing up going, wait a minute. I work for that money.
That's right.
You know, another thing we found out in Michael Moore's movie, Capitalism, A Love Story, is that the tax rate was 90% on the rich in the 40s and the 50s, even probably earlier. And that money was taken to fund all our infrastructure projects and to make America what it became, you know, in the 40s and the 50s, the interstate highway system, all that stuff, the roads and the bridges, whatever we needed, it came out of that fund where rich people paid their generous fair share, actually more than other people, but everybody understood why.
That's what's called a progressive income tax. You know, a lot of people talk about a flat tax. We should all be charged the same. But the truth of the matter is that wealthier people can afford a higher tax rate. They certainly get more than their share of benefits out of this system.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way it's been. Tax... You know, if they, you know, let these tax cuts for the wealthy expire on December 31st. I mean, that would only roll rates back to where they were in the early part of the century, nowhere near what they used to be, even in the 80s and 90s, corporate tax rates. It was an interesting thing. I think it was Sunday a week ago on one of the Sunday political talking heads programs. Oh, it was Christiane Amanpour, and she had Warren Buffett on. One of the wealthiest men in the country, right?
What did he have to say?
He was talking about how he doesn't need a tax cut, how trickle down doesn't really trickle down, which is the theory, you know, you give the wealthy the tax break, they're going to create jobs and things like that. He said it doesn't work. But then he also said, you know, he runs a very successful investment company, Berkshire Hathaway. And he said they did an informal poll around the office of everybody who worked there. It's like 14 or 15 people.
And they all make over $250,000 a year. They would be affected by it, right?
No, not all of them. We're talking about the secretaries in there as well, you know, who are probably being paid pretty well, but they're not making $250,000 a year.
Uh-huh.
And of all these people, Warren Buffett, by far the wealthiest one among them all, had the lowest tax rate.
Really? Oh, he's the most wealthy, and he had the lowest tax rate?
Yeah, and he said, you know, I don't do anything fancy. I don't have offshore tax shelters.
Big loopholes.
He
and
said, you know,
write-offs.
My accountant just takes what the federal government gives us for tax breaks and fills out the tax form, and I pay it. And all those tax breaks for the wealthy, you know, and what we're talking about here with the Bush tax cuts is by no means the only thing in the tax code that benefits these people.
Right. There's a lot of it. They've secretly, or no, out in the open, they've rewritten the tax code quite a few times.
There are sections in the tax code that benefit one person. seriously, you can read, you know, portions of the tax code that say if a person invested in such and such before midnight of it is so detailed, it is one person that's getting this tax break.
So they
or one corporation.
So they paid some money to get that written in.
Yeah.
That's called an earmark, right?
No, this is in the tax code.
Right. No, I mean, it would have been an earmark into the tax code when they were writing it. Meaning, you know, they have the Tea Party went up there talking about we're going to get rid of earmarks.
Yeah.
But it turns out a lot of stuff gets done through earmarks.
A lot does. You know, earmarks are more money that Congress is spending that a representative or a senator can direct some of that by inserting language into a bill to come back and benefit projects in their own state. There was an interesting article over the weekend in the New York Times that leading senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye, who's been in the Senate for, I don't know.
A long time.
A long time, 30 years or something. The economy of Hawaii depends on tourism and earmarks from Daniel Inouye, basically.
Uh-huh.
You know, and some of this stuff is good. It you know, the earmarks go to educational institutions to start a new research center. It's not all graft and corruption.
Right.
And it's also a very small part of the federal budget. It's another case of much sound and fury signifying nothing. I mean, if they got rid of earmarks tomorrow, we'd still have the deficit. You'd hardly see a dent in it.
That's that dilemma I'm thinking of when the Tea Party people get up there and they're going into Washington for what they were sent for, what they're saying. They're going to find out that the system's rigged completely against them and all their constituents. And that they've actually got themselves in a box where they're going to have to vote against their own best interest.
Yeah, well, the Tea Partiers who got in are probably such ideological purists that they won't end up voting against their own ideology.
That would be good.
Maybe against their own best interest. I mean, this whole thing of let's reduce the deficit now is against the entire country's best interest. This
right.
is what we should have learned from the Great Depression. And I've talked about this on this program before, but the lesson of that was that, you know, Roosevelt got the Works Project Administration started and all these stimulus packages going and started getting, you know, people employed. And we started to pull out of the Depression, and everyone freaked, and they started looking at the level of government spending and seeing that a deficit was building up. And they got very nervous and said, oh, we've got to reduce the deficit now. And they reversed all the trends that Roosevelt had started. And the economy took a nosedive again. And we were almost back into the same situation as the Great Depression. It didn't quite go that way.
That's what they call the double dip, right?
Yeah. And now, you know, this is in the most basic history textbooks, you know. And it is history repeating itself with all these Republicans and, to be fair, a lot of Democrats coming up there and saying, we've got to reduce the deficit.
Yeah.
What we need is more government spending. That's the role of government when the economy is in trouble. The government is the one that has the money that can stimulate the economy.
Right.
And so to turn off that faucet, you know, it's already had its effect in that the stimulus that Obama passed was a good thing, and it did save or create a lot of jobs, but it didn't do nearly what needed to be done at the time, because the criticisms coming from the right reduced the amount of what the stimulus really should have been. And, you know, economists up and down the pike were saying this at the time. This is okay, but we really need to be spending two or three times this on the stimulus.
Bailing out a sinking ship with a teaspoon.
Now there's no hope of getting any kind of stimulus spending to come out of Washington, probably until everything comes crashing down around our ears again.
Right. Well, when the unemployment rate reaches 15, 17, or 20%, and the Tea Party people are in the next 2 years, and it very well, the unemployment rate might reach that. I guess they're going to have to do something, aren't they? And the people are going to be screaming for jobs or unemployment checks. And again, you know, it's not just the Tea Party people, but now the Congress, not the Senate yet, but the Congress is going to be controlled by these right-wing, for lack of a better word, extremists. Well, they're going to have to put up or shut up, and the American people are waiting for something. They need something, right?
Yeah, you know, the Tea Party activists, the Republican Party as a whole, you know, really didn't respond to what the people wanted and what they were voting for.
No, they didn't.
People were voting the way they did because we had a 9.5% unemployment rate, and they wanted jobs. Republicans didn't run on any kind of platform that included job creation. They had no ideas on how to create jobs.
The rich some more money.
By attacking deficit spending, they're actually risking losing more jobs, because the only place the stimulus is going to come from to be able to pay for those jobs is by direct intervention by the federal government. That it's one of the roles of government that, you know, is kind of underlies this whole social contract between the people and, you know, are agreeing to be governed by this system of government, is that there are certain things that only a federal government can do. Protect the rights of minorities is one major one. You know, if we left that up to the individual states, African Americans still wouldn't be voting in, you know, in the Deep South, and let alone the Native Americans, you know, that are documented in Dorothy Fadiman's film.
Right.
You know, so this is one of the main roles of a central government. And in terms of the economy, this is one of the primary functions of a central government, is to intervene in that economy when there's no other agency that can do it. Large corporations aren't doing it. Wall Street certainly isn't doing it. I mean, they took their bailouts, but they didn't turn around and start loaning that money out to places that are trying to create jobs. That leaves the central government, and we are going in exactly the wrong direction now with the Republicans coming in, and they're coming in with no program.
Right.
They ran against the Democrats. They ran against Obama. They didn't run for anything.
They've actually admitted they want to just see him fail, so they're going to do whatever they do
right.
is going to be to see him fail.
They are not interested in governing. Governing is much too hard. They're only interested in
making him fail
the next election, 2012.
Yeah. Right.
So presumably they can put through even more tax cuts for the wealthy.
Now there is
you have to hand it to them though. I mean, they take care of their own. They get these large corporate donations to run their campaigns,
right.
and they get to Washington and they return the favor.
Now we all know lobbyists hit them all, right? And again, I'll go back to the Tea Partiers. When they get in office, they're going to get hit by those same lobbyists, the healthcare people, the insurance people, the petroleum people, the pharma people, all the different lobbyists, right? What is there, 25 or 30 for each member of the House?
Yeah.
They're going to get hit, and I hope there's some way we can get the information on who's taking money from the lobbyists.
Well, they're already... dealing with the lobbyists, you know, the incoming House freshmen are in Washington,
yeah,
and they're
getting lined up,
and they're getting oriented. Well,
with the pay system.
Well, orientation in Washington D.C. includes an almost endless stream of parties and receptions,
really
put on by lobbyists.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's how they get them.
They're going from one party, not political party, but a literal party with drinks and cheese and stuff,
uh-huh.
To the next that are all organized, paid for. By lobbyists. This is how Washington works.
And they get a big budget too, don't they? When you become a member of Congress, you get some real nice it's not just you get a little office and you get your salary. You get a budget for a staff.
Yeah.
You get per diem to fly around, do whatever you need to do. It's some serious money, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But you know, you would want your congressperson to be able to hire a staff. I mean, Congress people do a lot more than just vote on bills in Washington.
As long as they're not on the take.
There's you know, a main part of what any congressional district office does back in the home district is what's called constituent services. They help people deal with the federal government, you know, which is a huge bureaucracy. Well, one of the major things that a member of Congress does is help his or her constituents deal with the federal government, find out where they go to get the answer, what the answer is, what their rights are, you know, mm-hmm. what programs might benefit someone. That's a big part of what a congressional office does.
Think the average American knows about that, is aware of that?
Probably not until you find yourself in a bind with the federal government and decide, well, I better go see my congressman and see what he has to say about it.
Have you used that system, Paul George? Have you gone down that road?
No, I haven't had the opportunity to do that. I try not to get too involved with the federal government. But.
No, but it would be nice to see that, you know, like you're saying, if the local's office is set up and they're being paid to help the citizens, then maybe the citizens should start exercising that and saying, hey, dude, we need some help here.
Yeah,
what are you going to do?
The kind of thing I'm talking about is, you know, say a soldier comes back from Afghanistan and is running into trouble with the Veterans Administration,
uh-huh.
you know, getting medical care or treatment for post-traumatic stress or something like that. It's often the congressman's office that can cut through the red tape and help these people out. That's really important stuff.
We did see that last week where that kid, the nursing student at San Francisco City College or State, Asian American, had been caught by ICE and was going to be sent back, maybe not Asian, and Dianne Feinstein interceded,
right,
got him taken out of jail. And he's going to get to stay, I think.
Yeah.
And that was all, I guess, her doing. But somebody got to her. The kids protested. Isn't that amazing that when a senator gets involved, they can actually have a difference?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a complex system, and it's not all just voting on Capitol Hill. But a lot of it is dealing with these lobbyists.
Uh-huh. And, how do you think it would change politics, Paul, if we made a new set of rules and we said, if you want to be a public servant, then you should live in public housing? And if you want to be a public servant, you should take public transportation. And if you want to be a public servant, that means you want to help. So really, do you need that much money? We'll pay your staff. We'll take care of your family. But do you really need to get a big, fat salary for this? Because you're here to help, right? It's almost like a volunteer thing, isn't it? I mean, not that they should have to volunteer, but would it be too much to ask that we tell you that we don't want you hanging around with those lobbyists? We'll have a filter. We'll have some kind of monitor to make sure they're not paying you exorbitant amounts of money or getting, you know, giving you things to pass their bills. Would that be too much to ask, you think?
Well, you know, to me, the problem is not so much the perks, their salary and their, you know, their office budgets and things like that. It's the way elections are financed. We need public financing of elections in this country so that the electoral system is not so dependent on corporate money and Wall Street money. Everybody, a dollar out of everybody's taxes or something goes to a public fund.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who wants to run for Congress, who can demonstrate a minimal level of support, gets access to this fund. And so it's a level playing field.
Right. And doesn't have to buy $1 million minutes of media.
That's where the corruption really comes in. And then, you know, the lobbying system obviously needs to be tightened up.
Dismantled.
You have to have some way that people can go and express what they want to Congress.
Yeah, people, not corporations.
That's the thing.
They should lock out the corporations. Paul, we're just about out of time. You're on TV tomorrow night. People could go on peaceandjustice.org to see the whole thing, find out when and where. Next week, the Dorothy Fadiman film, Taking Back...
Reclaiming Their Voice.
That's it. That's here in Palo Alto. Peninsula Peace and Justice is putting that on, and you can go on peaceandjustice.org for that. Dorothy Fadiman will be our guest next week. Any parting words for the folks before we go off?
Well, just a little self-promotional tout here that I'm blogging at orwellwasanoptimist.org, so I invite you to stop by my blog, orwellwasanoptimist.org.
Right on. Paul, thanks for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's do it again soon.
Happy holidays, Burton.
You too, Paul.